You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
From privatization of public water systems to community efforts to block corporations away from local water sources, water scarcity is likely to become a major issue in the United States in the coming years. That's what Alan Snitow and Deborah Kaufman and Michael Fox argue in their book, Thirst, Fighting the Corporate Theft of Our Water. It's published by Wiley Jossie Bass, and I'm very pleased that it has brought two of its authors, Alan Snitow and Deborah Kaufman, back to my show today. Hello.
Oh, thanks for having us.
The last time you were here was in 2004 when you talked about your documentary on the matter of water and privatization. In the film, you presented stories from three different parts of the world: Cochabamba, Bolivia; Rajasthan, India; and Stockton, California. Why did you decide to focus your book only on the situation in the United States? Deborah?
Well, after we did the film, we were traveling around the country showing it to people, and everywhere we went, we were hearing stories about water scarcity, water issues, and especially about privatization of water resources and services here in the United States, and amazing stories from watershed to watershed that weren't being told. And particularly, there were stories of communities and coalitions that were getting together that were fighting back against the takeover of their water by corporations.
So when you were working on the film, Alan, you had no idea that this was going on all over the United States?
We had heard a bit, bits and pieces about it, but nothing as extensive as it turned out to be. And what we found out was that in the late 1990s, three multinational companies, all in the 100 largest companies in the world, had bought out fairly small private water companies in the United States and were planning an enormous expansion. They were planning to take over the water systems for a great deal of the country, because 85% of Americans get their water from public water services. And the companies wanted to really change that level of percentages.
And all of these major players are based abroad?
The three big ones are. Veolia and Suez are both French companies, and France privatized a primarily private water system. And the other one was RWE Thames. RWE is an energy company in Germany, and Thames is the London water supply. And they're the three big ones.
And so the English, the French, and the Germans all have privatized water?
Well, and it's coming here, too, because of this faith that the market can do things better than the public services that we've had up to now for the last 100 years. And, you know, there's a reason they're coming here, and it's because our infrastructure is decaying. There hasn't been a lot of investment. And between, you know, the Reagan years and now the Bush years, there's just been this effort to underfund the cities. And so it is true that we've got problems with our urban water systems.
And New York City has vowed to put a lot of money into upgrading ours, but that's a special case?
No, I think that that there's a commitment in New York City to maintaining public water. I mean, the water tunnel number 3 that's being built from Manhattan, Queens, and Brooklyn is this, you know, what, 50-year-long project and many billions of dollars to bring in another source of drinking water into the city. And I don't know if your viewers know, your listeners know this.
Well, but they're all watching their radios as we speak.
This enormous tunnel underneath the streets is a fantastic thing. They can't even close off the old tunnel because they're afraid that they wouldn't be able to reopen it.
But, you know, you're asking the right question about are other cities doing it. It's going to cost billions of dollars, maybe between $500 billion plus to $800 billion, to fix and improve the water systems in the United States. And there has to be some kind of a commitment on the part of the public.
New York also has another advantage. We're in an area where there's a lot of water available. But water has always been a finite source, and for some places, places where drought is a concern, or places where water has to be imported from elsewhere, like Las Vegas and Los Angeles, hasn't it always been an issue? Hasn't scarcity always been an issue?
It's the big issue across the West. In particular, in places where there's scarcity, the people who control water are usually the people who really control the society. And right now, with global warming coming in, we're going to be getting much more unpredictable water supplies because there's not going to be so much snow in the mountains. And even on the East Coast, that nor'easter that just happened, I mean, this is going to be happening more.
But can we blame climate change for this? The film Chinatown was about water scarcity in the 30s, wasn't
it? Right, and despicable characters who are very greedy and coming in to make a profit off of water because, as Alan said, it's really those who control water control power. Things are different now, and it's because this decaying infrastructure, it's because global warming is having an impact. There is less snowpack in the mountains, in the Sierras, for instance.
About changes in rain patterns?
Yes, it's gonna mean changes for all Americans, whether you live on the East Coast or out in the West or in the plains. And this is why private corporations are seeing gold. I mean, they're calling the water blue gold, or the oil of the 21st century, because when there's scarcity, there's the opportunity to make a profit.
Well, we regulate the phone industry. We regulate electricity. Is there any regulation of the water industry?
In places where there are local utilities run by private companies, they usually go to some kind of state commission, a public utilities commission or something like that, for the setting of their rates. But one of the things that we've seen, and you really see it with the Bush administration, is that large industry actually captures its regulatory agencies. And so the regulators really spend most of their time talking to the companies and generally become under the influence of the companies. And what our sense was, and that many Americans that we talked to, their sense was, is that this is really a public trust. You don't turn your police department over a private company, although there are people who talk about doing that, and you don't turn over most of your education or your hospital, the public hospitals, but water is as basic a public trust and commons.
My guests are Alan Snitow and Deborah Kaufman, filmmakers who, along with Michael Fox, have now written a book published by Wiley called Thirst, Fighting the Corporate Theft of Our Water. And this is WNYC. Well, there's always been privatization of water in some parts of the country, but you said mostly by small companies. Has it worked well, or have there been problems all along with them as well?
Well, about 100 years ago, even the New York City water system was a private, and it was an abysmal failure. The pipes burst, fire hydrants didn't work, there was a gigantic fire here that burnt down everything in the middle of the 19th century, and that's one of the reasons that water became a public service in the United States. It demanded the funds and the large amounts of money that were required of a growing nation and large populations with big urban centers. And we now have one of the great water systems of the world. And having made the film and traveled abroad to places like India, where you really can't drink, or you can't trust the water that you're drinking out of the tap, we take it for granted, totally, what a great system we have here.
Well, you've made a film in which you included Stockton, which isn't all that far from where you live in Berkeley. Is California a city-by-city situation? Would San Francisco have a good water system?
San Francisco has one of the great water systems.
Similar to New York?
Similar to New York. In fact, with New York, San Francisco, I think, is one of the very few that have unfiltered water. You get it straight from the watershed as is because it's so pure. So these are, some of the big success stories in water. In New York, the story of private water in New York is an amazing one. Aaron Burr founded a private water company called the Manhattan Company. The story there was that he really wanted to create a bank. And he used the water as a way of getting subsidies that he eventually then turned into the bank. And it eventually became the Chase Manhattan Bank.
Well, when water first started being sold for a dollar a bottle, I remember many people saying, gee, why would I buy it when it's free? A lot of people do buy water, even in a city like New York, where they can get it pretty much free. I guess we meter it to the people who use it in large quantities.
That's really a triumph of advertising, because that's a new phenomenon. It's only about 10 years old in the United States,
but
this bottled water thing.
Doesn't it also suggest that some water isn't as good as other water?
Well, that's very much what they'd like to suggest. But in fact, there have been a number of studies that have shown that some bottled waters have higher contaminants, higher levels of arsenic than your tap water.
Yeah, in Cleveland, for example, Cleveland collided with Fiji water, which comes about 7,000 miles, not exactly a great thing for your global warming. But Fiji's advertising said it's not bottled in Cleveland, it's pure. And the Cleveland public water people took some umbrage at that, and they did a test of the Fiji water and found it had higher levels of arsenic than would be allowed in their public water system.
A listener from Long Island says that his water is owned and operated by a German company, and he gets mailings from them asking him to buy insurance for his water supply and equipment. Is that something that's happening around the country? Have you heard about that before?
One of the most common features of privatization is that rates go up, and so consumers, because that's, of course, how the private company is going to be making a profit, is either rates going up or their costs going down, which means that they're not investing in the infrastructure, which is a very bad sign. So that's the first thing consumers usually see is a rate increase.
Is water privatization similar to deregulation in the energy sector?
You know, one of the ironies in California was that Enron, which of course was into deregulation, was also one of the biggest water companies in the world. They wanted to do with water what they were doing with power in California, which is sort of corner a certain part of the market and be able to sell it at inflated prices. And so deregulation has a lot of similarities, and the question is actually ownership and regulation are very closely connected questions.
Aren't there public-private partnerships being developed? Are they better?
Well, public-private partnerships can work in a number of different areas, but very often it's a euphemism for loss of government control and the getting rid of government responsibility. And in particular with water, they're now talking about 20-year contracts. And once you give a private company management and control of your water system for 20 years in a monopoly situation, you really don't have the capacity anymore in government to bring it back under your public control.
And by the way, these public-private partnerships are advocated both by the Republicans and the Democrats. So, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon. The resistance to privatization of water is unique because it's very bipartisan. It's really people that are for local control don't necessarily like the idea of these giant multinationals, whether they're based in Europe or they're based in the United States. They don't like the idea of their rates growing up. So these public-private partnerships, I think, are kind of a cover for this increasing infiltration of basically the private capture of our water systems.
And you say that there's another kind of partnership developing between disparate groups in America, groups that we might not normally think would want to cooperate on something but are all opposed to privatization of water?
It's really sort of wild. People have a very visceral reaction when they think that they're losing local control of their water. And we found that as we travel around the country, that we found these coalitions forming against public-private partnerships and privatization that were amazingly diverse. Republicans, Democrats, evangelical Christians and anti-globalization activists, and good government types, the League of Women Voters and so on. And it reflected this enormous consensus really nationwide. When you ask people, Republican pollsters have asked people, do you support federal money and dollars going into clean water? This pollster, Frank Luntz, sort of top guy, said they found 86% of people supported that idea. It was a consensus of a sort that he had never seen in all of his years in polling.
It was one of the things that made writing the book fun, was seeing these different coalitions. And, you know, in Lexington, Kentucky, it was the bluegrass horse breeders with environmentalists, you know, all kinds of things like that.
Well, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Lexington, Kentucky, and Felton, California, and some of the other places that you have written about. My guests are Alan Sinitow and Deborah Kaufman, who, along with Michael Fox, have written Thirst, Fighting the Corporate Theft of Our Water. It is published by Wiley, actually the Josie Bass imprint of John Wiley and Sons. Stay with us. We're back with Alan Sinitow, S-N-I-T-O-W, and Deborah Kaufman, filmmakers who, along with Michael Fox, have written a book called Thirst, Fighting the Corporate Theft of Our Water. It is published by Wiley, and as I said earlier, it grows out of a documentary they made some years back, but is really quite different. I think the only thing that you cover here that you covered in that film was the situation in Stockton. But let's talk about some of the instances that you cover here. You explore cases where the public has attempted to buy back a privately held water company. So what happened, in Deborah, in Lexington, Kentucky?
Well, it was a battle that began many, many years ago and continues on right now. So that's, as do many of the stories in our book, which have inconclusive endings. A private company named American Water had been bought by a giant multinational called RWE in Germany, based in Germany, known as the Enron of Europe, actually. And people didn't like the idea of their profits or their fees going to, you know, pad the pockets of shareholders and CEOs in a faraway land. But also they were concerned about their services and what was the declining services. And they formed a coalition. What was interesting to us was that the coalition to take back the private water company and put it into public hands again had not only the support of the mayor, you know, traditional power brokers in town, but the Kentucky horse breeders, who became very, very involved because they cared about open space and land and the preservation of what they had, as well as environmental activists, the Sierra Club, and groups like that. So it was kind of the old school with the new school.
Well, were they able to buy back their water rights?
No. In fact, the elite nature of the coalition in Lexington was in part responsible for the failure, because they did not mobilize enough grassroots support. In all of these cases, you've got, you know, huge companies going up against grassroots groups that don't have much in the way of resources. So you really have to have a lot of grassroots mobilization to succeed.
Well, the German company in Lexington is the same one that is operating in Long Island. So I guess they're all over the place. How did the situation in Kentucky compare to the fight in Felton, California?
Well, in Felton, they're proceeding with an eminent domain procedure to, you know, take back through the courts the water system. It's a much smaller community. We're talking about a community in the mountains of about 3,000 homes. And they're moving forward with this, petitioning to the Public Utilities Commission in California and hoping to succeed. But they have overwhelming support from the community. When they had an election to support the eminent domain, it was overwhelmingly supported.
What happens?
Once you lose control of the, you know, once these companies are in private hands, getting them out of those private hands is like, you know, getting property. I mean, they used to talk about the mort mav of the Catholic Church. Once you own something, you'd never see it again. And that's true of these water companies. It's very tough to tear them away.
But when we have these kinds of fights, usually there is an advertising battle, a PR battle. Did we see that sort of thing in these cases?
Yeah, I mean, it was really an uneven playing field, I guess is what you'd call it, because the private water company has so many more resources besides, you know, legal resources and finances. They hired four different PR firms to advocate on their behalf in Lexington. They create phony grassroots groups, they call them AstroTurf groups, to be front groups, essentially, for the corporation. They do amazingly devious things and tricks in order to maintain their control. And that's what we're documenting in the book.
In the two cases you cited, the mayors were in support of getting back control of water. But in the case that you dealt with in your documentary in Stockton, California, Mayor Gary Podesta was backing privatization. What was the reaction of the people of Stockton to that?
Well, Podesta said to us and to other people that he wanted government to act more, that treated citizens as customers, and that this was his philosophy.
So this was an ideological thing?
This was an ideological thing. He was really tied into the idea that the private sector should do everything except police and fire for government. And so he wanted to get these things sort of off the books of the government and send them over. And the problem is that he ran into a firestorm. He actually told the National Conference of Mayors in a speech after this that you shouldn't get involved with privatization if you've got a faint heart, because you run into so much opposition on a grassroots level.
And what happened? In this case, has the privatization been stymied?
It's not been stymied, but it has been attacked, and it's like this is the 100 Years' War kind of idea. They were able to privatize by a 4-3 bitter divided city council, but now it went into the courts, and the courts have supported the community groups in overturning the privatization. So it's all in appeals, but the private company still is in control.
But several years later, all of the kind of bad nightmares that the citizens groups had about the privatization have unfortunately come to pass. The rates have gone up. There have been unfortunate contaminant and pollution dumpings and fish kills. The infrastructure is not being repaired to the extent that it would have been under the public. So there's been a lot of damage that's been done.
And
the smell is
worse,
too.
Huh? What's happened to Gary Podesta?
Well, Podesta then ran for higher office, and in the most expensive state legislative campaign in American history, with a lot of support from Schwarzenegger, and largely because of the privatization controversy and his high-handed methods, he was defeated. He didn't even win in his own county. So he's now head of the Republican Party in San Joaquin County in California. But he really got hit because of the way he drove this privatization through.
My guests are Alan Snutow and Deborah Kaufman, who along with Michael Fox have written Thirst, Fighting the Corporate Theft of Our Water. It's published by Wiley. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Perrier has also bought up some of the water, in this case, Wisconsin Dells, the Big Springs, because it was like Perrier in France? Is this bubbly water?
It's not bubbly water, but it's very fine spring water. And they came in to try to get a hold of water that goes into a series of wonderful trout streams in Wisconsin and caused a huge reaction from trout fishermen and as well as from environmentalists who opposed this whole idea. And Perrier, of course, had been bought by Nestle, which is the largest food and now water company in the world and in the United States. And they have, in fact, brands like Deer Park and Poland Spring and so forth are all Nestle company. And they generally tap into springs and pure streams and promote that as their new product.
We should say that.
But wait, doesn't that earn money for the area? Isn't that seen as a natural resource that they are able to make some money from?
Well, this is what they're offering when they bottled water companies when they come in, is that they're offering jobs, and that's been particularly enticing to people in government in Michigan, where the unemployment is so high and the situation is so, you know, dreary. So they have been able to make inroads in Michigan. You know, they're coming, they're in Maine, they're in California right now. A huge battle's underway near Mount Shasta over a Nestle bottled water plant. But we should say, you know, it is a huge growing industry, $10 billion industry in the United States, the bottled water. But only half of it is from springs. The other half is really just recycled tap water. So, I mean, the public doesn't really know that because they see these pretty pristine Alps on the label.
Yeah, as we get toward Earth Day, the other thing that's is that this is part of the whole tradition of the United States where you exploit resources. And in this case, it's real resource extraction that's going on for private profit.
Well, when we sell our own resources, public resources, to a private company, what happens to the money? Is the money something that is this a one-shot deal where the money gets to used to build roads or a new town hall or something like that? Or are there royalties that keep on coming to the local municipality?
Generally, the pay is peanuts compared to the value of the utility or to the resource. There's now a fire sale of public resources. There are toll roads being sold in Illinois. They're considering doing that. Corzine, before his accident, was considering doing that in New Jersey. All kinds of public assets are being sold. They're being sold for cheap for the most part, but they give a governor or a local mayor a certain amount of cash to be able to use to deal with popular programs that he doesn't want to cut.
And, you know, a company like Nestle is not only giving campaign contributions, but they're giving charitable donations also to keep up a good public image, so that the corporation kind of on the surface is looking like it's giving back in various ways to the community. But really, as Alan said, the extraction of this very, very precious resource that is dwindling is going to have a major impact.
One thing that we tell people, try not to forget, is that if you look at Evian water, Evian spelled backwards is naive. And that sort of says what's going on with the bottled water craze.
If there are so many people who are opposed, why does this continue to be a growth industry? We're seeing a lot of it in New England, for example.
Because there is enormous pressure from the companies to go into an area. They make a secret deal with this individual landowner who gets a chunk of change. And once they're there and have signed that deal, groundwater is not really controlled in many, many states. So people are suddenly up in arms, but they feel completely helpless that they can't really do much about it. So it's extremely profitable for the companies to come in like this fairly secretly, and very hard to get them out once they're in.
So they're just drawing water out of the water table?
That's right.
Yeah, and you've got somebody like T. Boone Pickens, the oil billionaire in Texas, who's buying up property in northern Texas in order to pump up the Ogallala Aquifer and ship it to drier parts of Texas to make a profit off of. So, I mean, this is seen as a big business opportunity to exploit our water resources.
That leads me to my next question, which is what impact has the water industry had on areas that are already struggling with water scarcity?
Well, this is still something that's going to be coming up as global warming really hits in places in the West. There's huge drought, for example, that's really starting and they're terrified of in the Southwest.
Well, cities like Phoenix are growing.
Right.
Las Vegas is now still the fastest growing city in the United States. Where are they getting their water from? Is everybody getting it from the Colorado River?
Exactly, they are. They're getting it from the Colorado, and now increasingly they're also going under deserts where there are ancient aquifers that will not be replenished quickly, and getting the water from those deserts as well. They're going anywhere they can. And there's also some people who say, well, how about the Great Lakes? That's a lot of water. It's 20% of the fresh water on the planet are in the Great Lakes. How about let's get some of that water and pipe it down to the Southwest?
I mean, we're hearing all kinds of crazy schemes now. I mean, you know, in addition to pumping up the Great Lakes, they're, you know, talking about dragging polar ice caps down to, you know, arid zones. So, I mean, you know,
well,
crazy
they're getting
entrepreneurial.
Loose right now. Maybe we can do that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're loosening by themselves if some of the pictures I've seen in films recently are any indication. Now, you said that you were surprised to learn about all of this. You were making a film about it. I would have thought that if anybody would have been aware of it, it would have been people who were doing that kind of research. That also suggests that most of the rest of us have no clue.
Well, the political dimensions of it, I think, is something that I wasn't aware of. You know, you hear about corruption in a place like Cochabamba or, you know, in a far-off land in Africa or something, but you don't realize that, you know, a mayor in a small town of western Massachusetts may go for a privatization scheme in order to then later become the vice president of the water company. I mean, there's this kind of revolving doors thing that's going on that, you know, you could label as kind of small-town corruption. It goes on all the time, but when you see it with a phenomena like water, you realize that this is really touching everybody, rich and poor, and it's, you know, a vast phenomena.
But you also have suggested there is an inevitability about it, that there isn't a heck of a lot we can do to stop all of this.
Actually, we're pretty optimistic about the possibility of stopping this. Water privatization is sort of like the far edge of privatization drive, sort of the way Social Security was by the Bush administration. And the federal government is trying to drive privatization by denying funds for clean water to states and local governments. And there is an enormous push now for a federal trust fund for water. There's resistance on the grassroots level. There's so much of a consensus on this that it, in fact, may be possible to stop this drive by the companies.
A listener wants to know who owns Evian. Or is that a naive question?
It's owned by, I think it's owned by Danone. I'm not sure. And it has
another major French
water company, and they have a marketing agreement with Coca-Cola or something.
You know,
like
interestingly,
that.
In France, where there's so much bottled water and private water companies, there is a growing movement of mayors wanting to take back and make public their water systems again. So it's kind of interesting that in the belly of the beast that there's a movement to make public water.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us today, Alan Snitow and Deborah Kaufman, who, along with Michael Fox, have written Thirst, Fighting the Corporate Theft of Our Water, published by John Wiley and the Jossie Bass imprint. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been fun.
Thank you.